Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Leftsetz podcast. Those people who follow me in my writing know that I'm a huge Doobie Brothers fan. I was not initially. I certainly like listening to the music, and then they were everywhere. So to any band that's everywhere and has that many hits maybe doesn't deserve my attention. But I spent the best month of my life in 1975 in a condo in Mammoth Mountain, which is a big ski area that you can usually ski to July 4th in California. And the guy brought his 8-tracks. And he brought this 8-track, was a combination of what were once Vices and The Captain and Me. And it just totally closed me. I mean, this morning I played Eyes of Silver on my Amazon Echo show. So it's a great thrill and an honor. And this is not BSing because I'm a huge fan to have from the Doobie Brothers, the legendary voice, Tom Johnston.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Bob.
Okay, so we always start at the beginning. Where, you know, like that old Cheech and Chong number, where was you born?
Just north of L.A. Well, not just north, but in the Central Valley in Visalia.
Visalia. For those people who are not California savvy, tell them how far from Los Angeles that is.
Probably about 2 hours north of L.A.
Okay,
so that's the old day. I don't know about now, but that's what it used to be. If you
Okay, but when you grow up in Visalia, what does your father do for a living?
He had an aircraft shop in Tulare.
An aircraft shop?
Well, he worked, it was an aircraft repair shop, maintenance shop for crop dusting and private aircraft. That's where I worked my whole childhood. That's what I did.
Okay, so if he's repairing those things, one would think that was he was a pilot, too?
He was a pilot.
And are you a pilot?
No. Yeah, I never did it. I don't know why I thought about it, but I didn't give up. I wanted a motorcycle horse.
You wanted to stay on the ground and have danger on the ground.
Well, I got flying out, so that wasn't a problem.
Right, but okay, so your father is an airplane mechanic, and your mother worked outside the home?
She was a homemaker, but she had her degree in teaching and stuff. They both came from little bitty towns in Missouri, and they came out in 1933. And him to get his degree in aeronautical engineering and her to be his wife, I guess. I mean,
so, but they met back in Missouri.
Oh, yeah. Sullivan and Bourbon, two itty bitty little towns right on what used to be Highway 66.
So you've certainly been there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the relatives are still there.
The ones that are still hanging in, yeah.
Okay, so they come, so where does he get his degree in California?
You know, I'm a little unclear as to where he got it. I was not born yet, and this was quite a while ago. I'm not really sure where he got his degree.
And they came for opportunity to California.
Well, him specifically to get, yeah, to get the gig with, get his degree, and then he went up to work. Nobody's going to know what I'm talking about here, but he went up to work eventually in Visalia at an airport called, that was run by Tex Rankin, who was a World War II guy, and this was in World War II, and he was a mechanic for P-51 Mustangs.
Really? So, okay, if you're growing up in Visalia, and your mother did teach, or she stayed at home?
She didn't teach at any time after I was taking air, as it were.
Okay.
She sometimes went over and did the books at the shop for my dad.
Okay, so how many kids in your family?
Three.
And you're where in the hierarchy?
The bottom.
You're the baby of the family.
Yeah, I think it's more. I think it's more like a mistake that wasn't supposed to happen.
Well, how much older are your other siblings?
Brother's 9 years older than me, and my sister's 7 years older than me.
Yeah, it does sound like you're a mistake.
Yep.
And what are your brother and sister, if they're still with us, what are they up to?
My brother took over the shop. In
oh, really?
My sister lives up in Oregon. She lives over there close to the coast. And
okay, I grew up in Connecticut, 50 miles from New York City, so we got New York TV, New York radio, but you're living in Visalia. Where are you getting your radio from and your TV?
Fresno. It's Visalia is right between Bakersfield and Fresno, so as I recall, there wasn't a lot of radio coming out of Bakersfield, but Fresno had a big station and a TV station, and so you were listening to that, but there was also a period of time when I was in my teens, there's a little bitty town called Fowler, California.
That I don't know.
You probably wouldn't. But it had this great blues station. That's all he played all day. And the guy's name was Happy Harold's House of Blues. And so I would listen to that a lot.
Okay. So you're the youngest. Traditionally, the baby gets their way. The parents, you know, they're tired from the other two children. They give you a little slack that the other kids didn't get. Is that true?
I don't know, because I didn't have that.
They were so far ahead of you, you had no comparison.
Yeah, and, you know, I followed my brother around when I was young and kind of got in the way and stuff. But I have to thank him for turning me on to Little Richard. That's how I got, and I was like 9 years old, and that was the first time I ever got to hear Little Richard, and he brought the album home, and he played it a couple of times. I played it every day.
So it's kind of like the Beatles. The Beatles started with Little Richard. Prior to that, was there music in the home?
There was. Dixieland, primarily. My dad was a Dixieland buff.
Okay, so until Little Richard came along, you were not a big music radio listener. You were not.
Oh, I listened. I listened to whatever was on, but nothing really grabbed me until Little Richard and Bo Diddley and even Elvis Presley and his early stuff.
Okay, so that is all pre-Beatles stuff.
Yep.
At what point do you then pick up an instrument?
I was playing clarinet and stuff. All against my will. I did not want to do this. This is from age 8 till freshman in high school. I played that and I played sax. And then, but at age 12, I started playing guitar. And I didn't take lessons on purpose. And I just said, I'm going to do this myself.
Okay, let's go back. You took saxophone and clarinet in school.
Mm-hmm.
So you learned how to read music.
For a while.
Yeah, that's my question. Can you read music now?
Nope.
Okay, so you pick up a guitar. Your parents buy you the guitar?
No, I bought it.
You bought it. Where'd you get the money?
It was only $12. It wasn't too bad. I bought it from a bass player friend of mine in high school. I mean, we weren't in high school yet, but I ended up being in high school. And we were in bands together. And $12 for a crack in the top old Archback Harmony.
And the dream was what?
Really wasn't so much of a dream. It was just kind of, I think, a rebellion thing, maybe. I just didn't want to be associated with those other instruments. Actually, I didn't mind the sax so much, but I really didn't like the clarinet. So the guitar was my thing. Nobody was telling me to do this. This is totally exploration for me, so that's what it became.
And how did you learn? You said you wanted to teach yourself.
I listened. I figured it out. I listened to, like, Jimmy Reed. I started with Jimmy Reed, so it's pretty basic. And sit down and figure it out on the guitar, which really wasn't that tough. And then I'd start building on that as the years went by. And pretty soon, by the time you hit high school, you're in high school bands and you're playing.
Okay, but
British Invasion and what have
you. Okay, but I just remember because certainly after the Beatles, we all got guitars and we all formed bands. And I've told this story before. I was in the bedroom of a friend of mine and we were playing guitars. He goes, now we're going to change key. And I said, whoa, I'm out. I don't have that natural ability. So some people have natural ability. Would you consider yourself to have that?
I never really thought about it. I guess so, to a point. I could hear this stuff. Nobody explained it to me so much. The only thing I ever learned from anybody about playing guitar, at least especially in those days, was how to make a bar chord. And then after everything else, I just kind of figured out.
Okay, so you had this $12 guitar. And you're practicing in your room.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you graduate to another guitar and start a band?
As soon as I could afford another guitar, which basically was a single pickup electric K and a crummy little amp from the music store in town.
Do you remember the brand of the amp?
You know, I don't. Because whatever it was really off-brand. It wasn't mainstream.
I certainly remember the K guitars.
A Marshall. You know?
Right, exactly. And, you were saying?
Didn't really start playing with people until I was probably a freshman in high school.
So freshman in high school, what year is that?
You mean what year in?
In like 1960?
Okay, so probably 61, 62, something
so this
like
is
that.
Pre-Beatles.
Yeah.
So you formed...
You had to know how to play Hideaway by Freddie King by that point.
That was my question. So you played that and what else?
I played a lot of blues stuff as best I could at that point. I wasn't way advanced, but I had also, by that time... As a freshman in high school, I had a kind of a life-altering experience. A buddy of mine that I used to hang with all the time, who was a senior, and I was a freshman, was way off into James Brown. And so James Brown comes through town on his first Apollo Theater album tour, town being Fresno. And he says, we got to go see him. I said, all right. Because I'd already heard the album by then. It was pretty amazing. So we went up and saw him, and I... Never seen anything like that in my life. It was amazing. I mean, the guy never stopped moving. Just constant power, constant, besides screaming and the amount of talent he had. In those days, he was even singing more than he did later on when he got into the heavy funk stuff. But huge show. He had like two drummers, bass player, two guitar players, chick singers, and they would come out in layers. They'd like, before he even did his show, there was like 45 minutes of, I think they were called the Blackberries came out and sang, and his band played, and then he came out and played organ, which was a little questionable. But when he hit the stage, it was just like a tornado hit the stage. It was insane. And there was people standing on top. This is at a civic center. Then they were up on top of these old wood, wooden-armed, iron-like seats.
Right.
Just, and they weren't all, you know, it was like black, white, everybody going nuts, going absolutely insane.
Let's go a little bit slower. I've driven through Visalia. I don't really know. Is it an integrated town? Is it all white?
No, Visalia was not at that point in time. I don't know what it's like now. I hardly ever go there. In fact, I basically don't. Tulare had a lot of blacks in it.
So to get to Fresno.
And Fresno did.
How did you get to Fresno for that gig?
Drive up the highway.
No, but somebody had it. Somebody had a license at that point?
Oh, Bobby did, yeah.
Okay.
He was a senior. I was a freshman. I didn't have a license.
That's why I figured. That's why I was asking. You were saying you're a freshman. And you're at the Civic Center in Fresno.
Exactly.
How integrated is the audience?
It was probably three quarters to a quarter.
Okay.
So the west side of Fresno is basically African-American.
Right.
And, but I, there was a lady next to me. She must have, at that time, she seemed old to me. Looking back on it now, I said, let's define old. But
right.
She was probably in her 40s, and she was standing on her seat, just like doing this. I'm going, I don't believe this. It was amazing. It really was. She was into it, man.
Okay, so any fear coming from Visalia being in an integrated audience?
Never thought about it.
Never thought about it. Racism was not an issue. No one, you know, attacked you. Okay, so you come home from the gig, and you say to yourself, what?
It's more of what I was trying to take away from what I just went through. That was amazing. I mean, I can't – it was – I say it's a life-altering event. It was.
You know, the people don't realize, I mean, they talk about it, but we used to go see bands. There were no video, no internet, whatever, and the experience would hang with us. We talked to people. They wouldn't really know what we was talking about. It's like you couldn't even play the record and get the same experience.
Well, there were, the people that I hung with in school had no idea what I was talking about. They didn't even know who James Brown was. So it was, I mean, other than Bobby, who also went to the same high school I did, but it was kind of a small cult, if you will, that knew what that was about. And as time went on in high school bands, I would play little blues, mostly rock and roll, anything from Chuck Berry to the Byrds to Box Tops to Little Beatles to... And then we'd do the other half of the gig would be James Brown music. And
really?
I'm the one that handled that end of it.
Are you going to give us a little demonstration now?
I don't think so.
Okay. At what point in your... Okay, so what kind of gigs are you playing?
This is like high school dances and stuff.
But in your community, were you known as like the musician, the star? Was there any stature? Or were you just another guy playing music?
There was a lot of musicians playing. I mean, for that size of community.
Right.
I mean, I was down the ladder from other guys that I knew that were a little older and had established names in
Visalia, right, yeah. Exactly. But it was also an era where you could be a king of your own town. And since your mother was a teacher, are you doing well in school?
I was doing okay.
You're doing okay.
I was never a big fan of school.
Okay, you're not a big fan, but it's not like you got into music and then all of a sudden you stopped paying attention to school.
No. I did my earnest best. I gave it a good shot.
Okay, so then... what point do you think, does it even happen at that point, you say, whoa, this could be a career?
I didn't think that way in those days. Although we did cut a record when I was a sophomore, but that was just kind of a fluke thing. And I cut another one when I was 18, and I did go down and try and shop it here in L.A., as a matter of fact, with a friend of mine. Nothing came of either one of them, obviously.
Well, what did you do? Just looked up record companies and knocked on the door?
Close.
And got total rejection, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that didn't discourage you?
Not really. I didn't expect much to happen. I had nobody representing me whatsoever, and I was on my own, and I was with this guy that had played drums and bass on the song when I was 18. And
did you write the song?
Yeah.
Okay. When did you start writing songs?
Probably when I was 15, I guess.
And did you take it seriously, write one after another, or just now and again?
I would write stuff for the band that I was in. You know, and we, and in essence, we kind of all wrote it, but I would write the lyrics such as they were. And it was kind of an offshoot of a Chuck Berry kind of thing. And the other side was kind of a quote-unquote half-soul, half-rock-and-roll thing. And it sounded very amateur.
Okay, because usually the initial songs you think are great, but really they suck.
No, they were pretty bad.
Okay, and at what point in this history did the Beatles hit?
62, as I recall.
So, I mean, for you. 62 was Love Me Do, but in the UK, they were on Ed Sullivan in 64. So in 64, you were still in high school?
Yeah, I was.
And so was this a revelation? Did you watch them on Ed Sullivan?
I did. And we had all these kids in school that were following the Beatles ardently, wearing the paraphernalia, the hats, the Beatle boots. Frankly, I thought I was a little hicky, but whatever. I thought they were okay. I thought they were, you know, some
so
of
you were
stuff.
Not a big Beatle fan.
No, I was more of a blues and.
And how about the Stones?
Stones I liked.
Okay.
So they were a blues band.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned them back. I mean, they used to have the Battle of the Bands on Saturday night on the radio, Stones versus the Beatles.
Well, the Beatles developed, and I became a serious fan.
Oh, really? When did you become a Beatles fan?
Probably by the time I was hitting freshman in college.
And that would be which Beatles songs, which Beatle albums, if you remember.
God, I didn't own any. I just listened to them on the radio. I wasn't a diehard Beatles fan.
What songs did you say, hey, this is pretty good?
Let me think. Hard Day's Night, Eleanor Rigby.
Okay, relatively early, but not the initial stuff. Okay, and you go to college, and you go to college where?
First of all, junior college in Visalia at a place called COS, College of Sequoias.
Okay, and you stay there for how long?
2 years.
And so you're living at home.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing music, and are you riding motorcycles yet?
I did buy one finally after all the years of working at my dad's shop. It wasn't much, but I did buy one.
Okay, and that's something that stuck with you forever to this day. You ride your motorcycle?
I don't ride anymore.
When did you stop?
I quit in 2003. And it's not because of, you know, you're going to break your neck or any of that kind of stuff. We had to move out of the house for a year to have it worked on, and we got back in, and I looked at it and I said, I'm done.
But you're done because you figure you'd beaten the odds and maybe something would happen?
No, it really wasn't. It's like somebody just turned a switch off. The interest wasn't there anymore.
How much did you ride before you the switch did go off?
I would call it weekend warrior kind of riding. I mean, I had various friends, guys in the band I would ride with, as well as a lot of guys that I knew around town and stuff. This is all in Northern California.
Right.
And we'd go ride up and down the coast and stuff like that. But I never took trips across the country or any of that kind of stuff.
And did you ever have an accident?
I had a couple.
And does your body still suffer the consequences?
Not that I'm aware of. Let's put it that way.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with Tom Johnston of the Doobie Brothers. I love getting people's stories. Whether they're a famous performer, manager, record label exec, or tech star, I want to know what makes them tick and how they became successful. This week, Tom Johnston tells us about going to college and forming the Doobie Brothers and a 50-year career that came thereafter. You can dial up my other conversations with artists like Paul Rogers, Cascade, and Shirley Manson by subscribing to the podcast on TuneIn, Apple, or your podcast player of choice. While you're there, be sure to rate and review the podcast. Okay, let's get back to more of my conversation with Tom Johnston. So you're in junior college, you're playing in bands, you finish 2 years of junior college, and then what?
I went to San Jose.
And why San Jose of all the other places?
Well, it was one of two places I got accepted. That had a lot to do with it.
There was San Jose, or what was the other choice?
The other
one
was Oregon. And
okay.
I went up there and looked at it, and I said, I don't think so. Because by that time, I'd already met... My sister lived in San Jose, and I had already met this bunch of people up there who lived up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I didn't know Skip yet, but I would not long after that. And
that's Skip Spence.
Right.
Okay, originally from the Moby Grape.
Moby Grape, yeah. There was this whole community that she knew and hung with, which I became involved with.
Right.
Before I ever moved up there. I used to go up there while I was in high school and hang out.
How far is that from Visalia?
That's about, what, 3.5, 4
hours?
Yeah,
it's relatively far.
Yeah. And we would drive up there on the weekends, and she'd let us crash in her place, and then we'd go hang out in the Hate and go to the Fillmore and watch whoever was playing, watch all the stuff in the streets, take it all in, go back and be Visalia for the rest of the week.
That would be tough.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, people have no idea what you're talking about. So you go to San Jose primarily because you get in there and you have a whole social scene started.
Yeah, and I was a graphic design major, and they had a good department for all that.
So then the first question, did you finish San Jose State?
I finished it time-wise. I was a semester short of the degree simply because I got some bad advice. And I took an industrial design class that did me no good at all finishing. I did all the rest of the requirements.
Okay. Bad advice meaning you thought this would help you graduate and it didn't.
Meaning I had no idea what I needed to do and what was required. This guy says, oh, you should take this. My counselor at the point at that time. Take this industrial design class and, you know, this is something you're going to need. Well, as it turns out, it kept me from graduating when I was supposed to graduate because it didn't fit in the curriculum of graphic design.
So did you ever get a degree?
No.
Okay. You, as Bruce Springsteen's mother says, you can still go back. You're ready to go back?
Yeah, I could, but I don't think it was tough. I got to say, there was a lot of really good artists up there. Really, right. People that could really draw. I mean, regular drawing, you know, like regular art type stuff. It, amazing. But they would have been good in the other field as well. I probably would have ended up doing pay steps. I was an okay artist, but I wasn't sizzling.
Okay, but while you're going to San Jose State, is your then music career burgeoning such that you think, well, maybe this graphic design thing is not my future?
The way that all came about, I went to, you know, I did the classes, but I was like half doing that and half hanging out in the Santa Cruz Mountains, hanging out in San Jose, playing in a couple of bands in San Jose. All this is all going on simultaneously.
Right.
I have to say that that's probably one of the best times I ever had my entire life. It was a lot of fun. I had a $40 room, and it was on 12th Street where everything started for the band. But it was kind of a music center, and there was always people in there playing
music. This is in San Jose.
In San Jose, yeah.
Okay, just for those who also don't know, how far to get from San Jose to Santa Cruz?
Oh, shoot. In those days, probably 25 minutes.
Oh, very close.
Santa Cruz, the town?
Yeah.
Not much more than that, really. Probably half an hour.
And then if you're not talking about the town, you're talking about the mountains?
I'm talking about Santa Cruz Mountains. That's not the same as Santa Cruz. I mean, right. It's the same idea, except the one.
There's a ridge of mountains between San Jose and then the beach. But I'm not a big expert there either. There are certainly roads, but there aren't that many businesses there, right?
No, it was pretty rustic.
Okay, but there were no gigs that you were doing up in the mountains, or were there?
Not at that time, no.
Okay, so you're living the life, and you're supporting yourself being a musician, or your parents are sending you money?
Actually, they did help support me as long as I was going to school. As soon as I stopped going to school, that was gone. So what I would do, and the other thing is, after the semester of school, you got this time to kill for summer. Well, I said, I'm not going back to Visalia. When I left that town, it was rearview mirror. I didn't want to go back.
Right.
And so I would either work in canneries the first time, which was a funky job.
Well, that's hard work.
It was hard work.
And good money, though?
No.
Oh. I know in Alaska it's good money, but no.
Not that kind of canneries, no. This is, like, I don't know, Dole or whatever it was. We were processing all this fruit and stuff. And you had to be there at 5 in the morning, and then you'd work till 2 in the afternoon. And
well, that's an incentive to do something different.
Yeah, sure was. And then after that, I did construction the next year. And anything so I didn't have to go back to Visalia. Not that I hated Visalia that much. I just, there was nothing for me there. So.
Okay, so how long did you work in construction and at the cannery?
One summer in one summer in the other. So
now
freshman
you're
sophomore year.
Now you're out of school. Then what's the next thing after when you're out of school?
Well, we cut our first album in 1971. The band got together in 1970.
We're talking the Doobie Brothers now.
Yeah. I was in two bands before that.
Well, let's go a little bit slower. So how long after college did the Doobie Brothers start?
Actually, I was still in college when the Doobie Brothers started.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Barely. But,
okay, but you were still going to school.
Yeah.
So tell us about the two bands before that.
They were just local bands. There was an old one called South Bay Experimental Flash that I was in for a month. And you know, they were just passing fancies. There was another one I don't recall the name of because it didn't last much longer than that. And then there was PUD, which was the band that was based in 12th Street, in the house on 12th Street. And that's with John Hartman, who was the first drummer of the band, came out from Falls Church, Virginia.
Right.
Along with his buddy who played bass, Greg Murphy. And I went and picked them up with a friend of mine in a van in San. They were living in San Francisco or hanging. I wouldn't call it living. They were staying in San Francisco. And we threw them in a van. We took them down, and they took up residency in 12th Street.
Okay, how did you even know who they were?
I want to say Skip had something to do with it.
Okay, so Skip Spence, legendarily not rooted to the planet, and in Moby Grape, which lasts for a very brief time, you meet him. What is his status when you meet him?
He was on his own. He had just finished cutting Ore in Nashville, a solo album. My sister introduced me to him
Sister's a hipster.
Pivotal moment meeting him because of him, I met a lot of other people and all these players that were in the Santa Cruz Mountains and in bands like Mountain Current and Chocolate Watch Band, all the kind of stuff that was around there.
Okay, you meet him. He's older than you. Yeah. I would assume you're somewhat in awe.
I was, okay. Matter of fact. Now, and he was a kind of a charismatic character anyway. He wasn't right. Your average Joe. He, besides being a little out there, and as you say, not necessarily in touch with the planet,
right.
We didn't know that back then. We were young and dumb, and we believe anything. But he just had this charisma. Like, people would flock to this guy. It was amazing. It really was.
Okay, was it you asking for things, or is he the type of guy who was giving? Hey, you got to know this person.
It just happened. Like, a lot of stuff in my life in that period of time, things would just happen. It's not really that I asked for anything. It's just we would jam together a lot. We played in a couple of throw-together bands, which is how I met Pat. We were
Pat Simmons of the Doobie Brothers.
Pat Simmons, I'm sorry. I should clear that up. He was in a band called Pachuco. If I start naming these people off, nobody's going to know who I'm talking about.
Don't bother then. Okay, but you go to get the two guys from Falls Church, Virginia, who you know through Skip Spence. Mm-hmm. You move them into 12th Street. What is 12th Street like? Is 12th Street the epicenter of hip area of San Jose, or is that just where you live?
It was a student ghetto. It was like, three blocks from the school?
Right.
But for whatever reason, it became kind of a musical mecca for a lot of musicians. I'm not saying everybody that played something lived there. They didn't.
Right.
But we had a basement, and in that basement, there was always a jam session. And I could come home from school, and there'd be one going on. I could, do whatever I did for the art program, and I usually would take whatever it was, and it would work for two or three classes, which freed up my time a lot more. It's a sweet deal, you know? And I would be down to jamming. And Skip would be in the heart of it sometimes. Other times, we'd have horn players. We had a band. The band I mentioned, which was PUD, was a power rock trio. But we also sometimes had some chick singers. We also sometimes had a horn section, so it would veer off into R&B land. It was kind of a mishmash of everything.
And how much were you gigging?
Not that much when you stop and think about it. We did play, but we didn't play a lot. We played, Ricardo's Pizza Parlor, and we played at the Student Union at San Jose. We didn't have a lot of gigs.
And at this point in time, this is just an avocation. You're really a student.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so then you're in PUD, and the next trigger moment is meeting Pat?
Yeah, I met Pat when we played over at the Gaslight Theater in Campbell one night. And
where's Campbell?
I do this. I have a tendency. Oh, you know where I'm talking about.
Right.
This is, it's just part of San Jose, really. I mean, it's all one big city now back then, San Jose was a very small town. Not small town, but it was a small city. Nothing like it is now, being the tech boom and all. But Campbell was out west of downtown San Jose, where I lived. And they had that little, it was just a little club/theater kind of place, more of a club. And Pat Simmons was playing with a guy named Peter Grant, and they were doing what would be called Americana now, what we used to call folk music, sort of. But a lot of finger-picking, and that's pretty much all it was. Peter Green was a banjo player, and Pat was playing guitar, and they were both really, really good. And I was there with John Hartman, Skip Spence, and I think Greg was playing bass. Greg Murphy. I should have
Right.
Clarify that. I don't know what happened, Greg Murphy. I haven't got a clue. So we were playing rock and roll, and I was singing. I was doing the singing. And we watched them play. I think they played before we did, and then we got up and played. And we were taking somebody else's place who couldn't make the gig.
Right. Serendipity.
Yeah. And so, you know, we got to talking. Pat and I got talking, and John was part of that. And we invited him to come over and jam.
Was Pat going to school or anything?
He was at San Jose State as well, although I never knew that at the time. I never saw him. Right. It wasn't a big enough school where that was easily, that wasn't hard to do.
So you invite him to come jam in the basement.
Right. And he did, and we did that a few times, and eventually we all just, you know, kind of decided, let's start a band.
Okay, so it wasn't a light bulb moment.
No, it was what I call a movement. It was another one of those things that just happens. No plans, no destination, let's just do this.
Okay, and at what point you form the band, at what point do you think, wow, this could be something?
I don't know that I ever really thought that at that point. Really, I was so happy to play, and we played quite a bit. We played every place around there, and then we eventually ended up in the Chateau Liberté, which became like the center point for so many bands in the area from all over, San Jose, Santa Cruz, San Francisco a little bit, not a lot. And it was just so much fun to do that and hang out up there. I mean, it was just a lifestyle. I didn't owe money for anything. I didn't have any money, but it all kind of worked out. It was probably the freest time in my entire life.
But you were making money being in the band when you did play that could pay your bills.
Yeah, but not a lot. I mean, we weren't getting rich by any means, man. It was enough to pay the rent and buy food, and that was pretty much
That's a big
the gas
change,
in the car.
Big change in America today. I mean, you're from California, but statistically, people don't leave where they grew up because they don't have the money. Whereas, you know, getting in your car and driving places in the 60s and 70s was a big movement. In addition, it was much cheaper to live.
Well, God, yeah, man.
I mean, today...
You could go 25 cents a gallon?
Exactly. I mean, today, you know, you could have a job and you still got to live at home.
I've heard about that, yeah.
So, okay, you form the band. At what point do they become the Doobie Brothers?
We had a gig to play one night. And we were sitting around the breakfast, or the table in the kitchen, we call it the breakfast table, whatever, the everything table. And I want to say there was some combustibles being used.
Okay.
And one of the guys that lived in the house, that wasn't part of that whole music scene, but just lived in the house, came in with his dog, which he was wont to do at any given time. And he said, you guys ought to call yourselves the Doobie Brothers. You're always doing this. And we all looked at him and said, that's a really stupid name, man. But we don't have a name, and we didn't. And we had a gig that night. All right, we'll use it for tonight. And we never got rid of the name.
Okay, so you become the Doobie Brothers. At what point do you have two drummers?
That happened, I would say late 71. Mike Hossack, we knew from cutting our first album up at Pacific Studios in San Mateo. He was in a band called Morning Rain. There was a lot of people up there at that studio. Santana cut his first album there. Keith Knudsen, who was a drummer later on, was in a band called Mendelbaum. They were up there. That's where we ended up. Skip turned us on to the guy that owned the studio. And we went up there and cut a demo. The guy sent it to Warner Brothers. We got sold on the basis of that tape.
A little bit slower.
Yeah.
How long had the band been together before you cut the demo?
Probably a year.
Okay. And did you have a manager at that point?
Let's define the word manager. We had a guy that hung around a lot, if you want to call that a manager.
So then, on Skip's advice, you go to the studio and you cut how many tracks?
It wasn't really advice. He just turned us on the guy that had the place.
Okay, so how many tracks did you cut?
Oh, jeez. Probably 5 or 6.
And any of those that appeared on the album ultimately?
Nobody.
Okay, Nobody, which is on the first album, and it was remade.
I think also Quicksilver Princess might have been on the first album.
Okay, how do you get it to Warner Brothers?
The guy that owned the studio sent it.
Okay, and how long after he sent it did you hear back?
Jeez, I don't know, man. It could have been a month. I'm not really sure. We were busy doing that all the time, so it was probably about a month.
Okay, you were busy doing what?
Playing.
Okay, you're busy playing, but in terms of the demo, this is the only demo you cut, and you only sent it to Warner Brothers.
Well, we didn't send it anyway.
He sent it.
Yeah,
right.
And Lenny Warnker and Ted Templeman came up to listen to the band the studio.
Just that fast.
It was pretty weird, yeah, because that doesn't happen, right?
No, it doesn't.
But they liked what they heard, and it was basically Lenny was running the show. And so they came up and watched us play, and then Joe Smith is the one that signed the band, but that was his position in the company at that time. We didn't know what any of this meant. We were green as green could be. We had no idea. And
but you must have been very excited.
We were. We were. Right. I said, can't believe this is happening. Same time, part of me was going, it isn't happening. You just think it's happening.
Right. Do you still think maybe it's just happening?
No. I've put in too many miles by now.
Okay. And the guy who owns the studio, he's doing you a solid or he wants a piece of what goes forward?
Oh, he definitely got a piece of what. Well, not of the, I don't think he got a piece of the album. Warner Brothers probably wouldn't have allowed that to happen, but he did make a boot album off of the demo tape. He wasn't a stand-up guy, let's just put it that way. And he did that to Santana, he did it to us, he did it to a couple other bands that had used his studio just to make money. And when it came to getting the front money that we got from Warner Brothers, I think we got $2,700 a piece, and we thought, Jesus, we're rich. So we all went straight to Leo's and bought new guitars.
Right.
They, on the other hand, got the lion's share of whatever the sum was. I'll never know. One of the guys, I'm not going to give up names here, but one of the guys bought a car, which he wrecked within a week and a half. The guy that owned the studio, he just probably bought more gear for the studio. I don't know.
You're listening to my conversation with Tom Johnston of the Doobie Brothers, recorded live at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. Hope you're enjoying this episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. If you want to see videos and photos and hear sound bites from Tom and our other guests as they join me in the studio, visit at TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, more of my conversation with Tom Johnston on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. Okay, so they sign you. The first record is cut where with who?
It was cut in that same studio, in Pacific Studios in San Mateo, with Lenny Warnker and Ted Templeman. Lenny Warnker was the head producer, and Ted was actually under the tutelage, I guess you could say, of Lenny.
Because he'd been in Harper's Bazaar.
Correct.
With the 59th Street Bridge song. You're cutting the album. The album is done. Are you happy with the album?
We were ecstatic.
Okay.
We'd never been in a studio, first of all, so this was all new to us. And we'd been playing every place you could find for probably more than a year, actually. And that was our existence. And we were driving around in a van, which the bass player at that time, Dave Shogren, his dad bought for him. And that was our life. And then the rest of the time was at 12th Street. And Pat didn't live at 12th Street. But everything happened around that house. And we just kept doing it. Even after we made the record, we went right back to doing what we were doing because you can't stop what you're doing. You got to pay the bill, so to speak.
Okay, so the record is made. How long until it comes out?
I don't know. Probably couple of months, 3 months. I honestly don't know.
Okay, but you were happy with the record. Did you believe it would be a hit?
I think at that time in your life, being as how you have no idea what a hit is, the first song that got put out was Nobody. I said, oh, man, it's great. This is going to do something, hopefully. It didn't. The album didn't do anything. Nothing did anything. It was, it went, as I call it, Teflon.
Okay, well, the funny thing is that is a great track. Okay, it was, you know, on your box set from like 20 years ago, that's the lead-off track, and it really hooks you. So the track was good enough. Why do you think it didn't happen?
I don't know. Any one of a number of reasons. We recut that song twice, actually, now that I think about it. Once in 2010 and then again in 2014 for the country covers with a bunch of country artists. Which actually is my favorite version of that song.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so the album comes out. It's a stiff.
Yep.
What does the label say? Because theoretically they could say, hey, we're done.
This is the time period when you could get away with that. And we were allowed to do another album. So we did. We started working on it on our own. We didn't have a producer, which was a huge mistake. And
why?
Well, because we didn't know what we were doing.
Was there no one to, you know, control the cats?
Yeah, I mean, what we'd had on the first album, for instance, we had a lot of guidance.
Right.
From Lenny, and it was, we were being cast as an acoustic-driven band.
Right.
Which really wasn't what we were.
Right.
But that's what he heard, and I said, okay, at least it's professional, we're doing something that's real, let's go do it. And we did some electric stuff, but mostly it was kind of a lot of acoustic stuff. And everything I wrote was kind of based around acoustic guitar, and everything that Pat wrote was kind of based around acoustic guitar, and more comfortable. He was more comfortable with that than I was, not because I didn't play a lot of acoustic, but because that was his main instrument, where I did both, but I wasn't as fluid on acoustic as Pat was. Mine was all about rhythm, the strumming style stuff, and his was finger picking, which he was really good at and still is really good at. And but I was also way off into the electric blues and soul music and R&B and all the rest of it. And eventually rock and roll with Cream, Hendrix, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you start making the second record alone, and it's a disaster.
Yeah, we needed guidance.
So
we really did.
So then
we,
what happens?
Well, we kept a couple of songs out of the batch of songs we started with, but only a couple. And then,
do you remember which songs those are?
One of them, White Sun, we kept.
Okay.
I can't remember what the other one was at the moment. They said, you guys are spending a lot of it. We were at Wally Hyder's in San Francisco.
Right.
And he says, Warner Brothers said, you're kind of blowing it. You're spending a lot of money. And we sent them tapes. And
right.
I said, no, I don't think so. So they gave Ted the job of going to Corrales, get us going in a direction. And I got to say, you know, I don't know if we were his first band, because I know he did...
Van Morrison?
Thank you very much. Yes, he did Van Morrison. I want to say it was around that era.
But you were his first hit.
As a band, yes.
Yeah.
And he really helped. He had ideas that, to this day, just blow me away.
Well, give me an example of one idea.
Well, harmony ideas, although we were a big harmony band anyway, but he would say when to do it, when not to do it, let's say, or maybe that's too much at that point. He, being a former drummer himself, would have tons of drum ideas. And just how a song was going, he says, what if you put the chorus here, put the two verses, then the chorus, and maybe a solo. This is your basic standard right out here. This is, okay, you're going to do verse one, then you're going to have the section between verse one and verse two, and then you're going to have the pre-chorus, then you're going to have the chorus, then there's a solo, then you're going to have the chorus, and this is all the stuff that's supposed to hook everybody, right? And... we kind of had the idea of that, mostly, but not the way that he would come up with ideas on how to do it. And it really helped. It helped a lot. And it continued to help progressively as we got more into writing better songs, more professional songs, I guess you could say, just from, because we started touring, bang, on the first album we started touring. And we started learning stuff about, you know, from other guys and other bands that we were playing with on the road. First one being Mother Earth in 1971, which was an eye-opener. It's the first time we'd ever toured. And by the time we did Toulouse Street and Ted became involved, for whatever reason, it instigated the writers to do better stuff. I have to say that is a fact.
Okay, so the album is called Toulouse Street. Why?
Well, it's the name of one of the songs on the album.
I know, but I mean, if you know, I was stunned. I was in New Orleans, and you see the sign, Toulouse mm-hmm. Street.
Absolutely.
But you're living in Northern California. Why is one of the songs Toulouse Street?
In 1971, we flew down to New Orleans to supposedly play with the Eagles and Chuck Berry, I believe it was, in some like football stadium thing or something, and we got rained out. So we didn't play anything. But we did get our first dose of New Orleans, which is a very intoxicating thing. New Orleans is so picturesque. There's so much history. The music of New Orleans is phenomenal. I immediately fell in love with all that stuff. And so we kind of became a Southern rock band, if you will, while, you know, I picked up the vibe, if you will, and the bands that all would come through that whole area, but not just there, but all Mississippi, New Orleans, the Carolinas, all that Southern rock scene was.
Well, was then you have there. To ask, did you have two drummers because the Allman Brothers had two drummers?
No, we did it because we thought it would have. John, oddly enough, it was John Hartman's idea to bring in another drummer for more power. John was always into like Mountain, Cream, Hendrix, Jethro Tull, whatever. And I have to say, it ended up being a really good idea. And I wasn't against it. I just hadn't thought of it. And we were using, the first night we ever did that was up at the Chateau, which was not a big room. It was a tiny little room. Ceiling was right above your head if you're standing on the stage. And we brought Mike Hossack in to play with us. And we didn't rehearse with it or anything. We just did it. And it was pretty crazy. But it felt good. So we adopted doing that, and then that became part of the whole, when you're writing the songs, you would include that whole thing going on. And we, of course, knew who the Allman Brothers were, and we were huge fans.
Right.
But it wasn't the driving force for having two drummers. And then we continued doing that for years and years.
So the songwriting, was it shared by the group or the people who wrote the songs?
The songwriting basically would be a guy comes in with an idea. It sounds like it started a good joke, right? But this happened before we even went up to Pacific Studios. I would write stuff and bring it in, and Pat would bring stuff in. This is all before we ever made the demo. And we would work it up as a band. You know, the bass player would come up with a bass idea. The drums would come up with their version of an idea for what we, unless we had something very specific in mind. And it was all trial and error. And we'd get it to where we thought it would sounded the best. And then that never really changed for a very long time. I mean, Toulouse Street, Captain and Me, Vices and Habits. But by then, of course, you had the direction of a very good producer and a very good engineer in Don Landy. So.
And then, but in terms of this late date, because when the hits stop, credits are very important, okay? So are the song credits, is the money shared as you see on the album, or is it shared with everybody who... It was in
from the album itself, album sales, that sort of thing. Points, you mean?
No, I mean the songs, not the album.
Whoever wrote it is the one that got the publishing.
Okay. So now you do Toulouse Street. You've done one album that you were happy with that's stiffed.
Mm-hmm.
Second album you've made. Now what are your thoughts?
Well, I think we grew a lot with that album. I know we did. And I think I give a lot of the credit for that, number one, to being in a better studio. But mostly from hanging out with Ted and hearing his ideas, because he was hanging around with some heavyweights in L.A., and he was learning some really good stuff. And he brought that in, and I think it changed the band, the quality of the band, and that's why I said I think we upped our game as far as our writing.
Okay, but when the record is done, do you now say, oh, this is going to be a hit, or you say, I've had one stiff, who the hell knows?
I don't think anybody really cared that much. I don't mean that in a, I don't care about this thing. I just, nobody was so... fixated on the idea of we gotta get hit, gotta have hit, gotta hit. It wasn't like that. It's just we cut the songs, and I wrote one song, which is Listen to Music, and I called Ted up at 3 a.m. and played for him. I wrote it in my bedroom on 12th Street, which is where I wrote Long Train Runners, where I wrote China Grove, where I wrote...
Maybe you gotta move back there.
Yeah, maybe. Well, there's a different time period. What you're doing in your life really affects what you're writing. I got to say, that's one thing I've learned. But I wrote a lot of songs in that room. And anyway, so I called him, woke him up, which he wasn't happy about, and I played it for him over the phone. I said, this is a single, and it's the only thing I've ever called in my life that I would
write
about.
So you knew?
I did know. At least for me, I knew.
No, I'm a big believer in that. When it comes to art, when you hit it, when you get an 11, you know. And when people you tell you they don't know, either they've never had an 11 or they're not a real artist. And you wait for those moments, you know, you don't know where they come from.
You don't, and that's the best ones.
Right.
Because you're channeling whatever that energy
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
I know how spooky that sounds or weird or hippie.
No, I totally agree.
But I believe it.
Okay, so Listen to the Music is on the album. How long after the album is released do you start to realize Listen to the Music is going to be a hit?
When I heard it on the radio. That's when I knew something was going to happen. And I was in my Volkswagen, which I think you've actually written about. I was in my Volkswagen driving down the road somewhere around San Jose, and on comes Listen to the Music. And I went, holy shit, that's us. Pull the car over, you know, turn it off, crank the radio, and sit there and go, I don't believe it. We're on the radio. That was a big deal,
yeah. Oh, yeah. It was also an interesting era because that was the FM-AM era, and most of the FM bands did not have hits that translated to AM radio, whereas Listen to the Music did, and the Doobie Brothers were gigantic seemingly overnight. What did it feel like on your end?
It really didn't happen overnight, for one thing, but it was certainly a start, and after that came Jesus Just All Right, and also Rockin' Out on the Highway, which was not as popular as those two, and Listen to Music being the most popular out of that bunch, and which led to another album.
Okay, before you get to the next album, now you're on the road, you're headlining.
All the time.
Are you headlining or opening?
We started out opening, and we played with anybody and everybody. We played opening for Ronnie Montrose, who at that time had Sammy Hagar as their lead vocalist. We played with Rare Earth a lot, who I loved. I thought they were a great band.
Right.
I didn't care if they did covers. I thought they killed. Redbone, we played with, people may not know who I'm talking about.
I certainly do.
Trying to remember some of the other bands we played with. Oh, Steely Dan. They were just getting started at that period in time. Do It Again, I think, was the first thing I heard by them. And Reeling in the Years after that. And
okay, so you, do you remember who your agent was?
No. You want to know why I don't remember? Because I paid zero attention to that kind of stuff.
Okay, at the time, were you living the life?
Yeah, we were. We were kind of the low end of it. I'm not saying we were getting our feet wet much more so than we had on the first album. But until The Captain and Me came around, we didn't really get to the stadium scene or the big halls and all that kind of stuff and headlining.
Okay, but other than the money that might come in from that, assuming it trickles down to you, there's the drugs, there's the sex, et cetera. Are you partaking of those?
It was rock and roll.
And you enjoyed it.
I did. I have to say that after a while, the way we were touring, which was over 200 dates a year, around 200 dates a year, happened very rapidly. And when that happens, everything turns into a blur. And in that way of living, of doing playing that many shows, always being on the road, I mean, we were, in 72, we were driving Winnebagos around. And then that morphed into driving, into flying on airlines, which frankly wasn't that much fun.
Right.
And we were touring with people like Mark Bowl and T-Rex and stuff like that. And we were, you know, getting around some heavier people, and because Ringo backed them, I backed Mark Bowl. And, but all the same, you were playing constantly, and it wasn't two on, one off like nowadays. It was five in a row, and then you get a day off. And your voice is gone, and you're shot, and you're pretty much, you know, you're pretty tired. And that continued through all the rest of the albums that, you know, up to and including Stampede as far as the life. I mean, you toured for that amount of gigs every year, and then when you weren't doing that, you were in the studio making another album. Except for a little time at home. So I'm trying to, I look back, I said, when the hell did we write the songs? Because it frankly is a blur. I mean, there's a lot of songs that I look back, except for a couple that have special stories attached to them. I don't remember anything about doing that, about writing that song. It's just part of the whole miasma of what was going on.
Okay, but you know, people wonder why musicians do drugs. And I always say, okay, you get off stage where 10,000 people think you're God. You may even, you know, have some sexual activity after that. Then you're in the vehicle with the same assholes you've known for years, and you can't come down from the energy, and then all of a sudden it's the next day. So you start with drugs just to wind down.
To a point, it was just like a scene. And whatever was going on is whatever was, you know, it's like you just partook of the scene. And sometimes it was pretty nuts, which kind of slowed down much later on. And, and there was the chicks, and there was all that stuff. But it was, you know, from one day to the next, it really wasn't outstandingly different. It was just all part of the same thing.
Okay, so tell me about making The Captain and Me.
Well, okay, we come off the road. We write the songs. I mean, the one song I can definitely tell you I remember writing is China Grove, in the same room as the other one.
You didn't upgrade your digs now since you're a big touring musician?
Nope. I did not.
Still paying 40
bucks? You know, we weren't making that much money. Everybody seems to think you get instantly rich. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. I wrote the songs that I mentioned earlier on. I think I wrote Listen to Music, China Grove. Long Train Running wasn't really a song in my book anyways. It was a jam. And I questioned Ted about putting that on a record. I said, we've been playing this since 71. I make up the words every night. The only thing that is a constant is Without Love, Where Would You Be Now? That's all we got. That's it. And then we'd play it for like 20 minutes, you know, on and on and on and on. So I didn't consider that a real song. So
I didn't consider it a real song, too, either. So it's interesting to hear.
Yeah, that's really how it went down. And I had to be talked into cutting that song. I said, I don't know, man. I said, really hits me as a jam. He says, well, why don't you go? We were working at Amigo Studios, which became Warner Brothers Studios, which was on Cumston, which is all that's gone now. But that was a real cool studio.
This is in the Valley, in San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
And, of course, Arlo Guthrie did the album called Amigo after cutting the record there.
Well, and he played on one of our albums.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we toured with Arlo. And J.D. Salad was hanging around there. Ry Cooder was hanging around there. Randy Newman was hanging around there. James Taylor was hanging around there. It was just all these people all the time, you know?
Sounds like fun.
It was. We had a really good time. I enjoyed working there. It was really a lot of
fun. So you're cutting The Captain and Me.
Yep. And I talked. Ted liked that song as well. He didn't think it was.
I love that song.
At first, I didn't think it was a single either. And I wrote it in the bedroom, and I wrote it on acoustic, and I said, no, this is an electric song. So I went and grabbed John out of his room. I said, we're going down in the basement, and we're gonna play this electrically, and we're going to play it really loud. And so we did. So I had drums and me, John Hartman. I should mention his name once in a while so people know who I'm talking about instead of me just going through what I'm thinking. And we were playing it. It was probably 1 or 2 in the morning. And, you know, it was pretty loose in that area. It was all students, and they really didn't care. They weren't bothered by it. And it was kind of a wild neighborhood. And so that was the beginnings of that. Until we got it into the studio, though, it didn't come to fruition as a song. And as far as the lyrics to that, after we'd been touring in 72 in Winnebago's, at some point in time, we were driving down the road that goes into San Antonio, Texas, and there was a road sign that said China Grove. I didn't remember it at all. I had no memory of that. However, I firmly believe that that planted a seed that popped out later on when Billy Payne, who played the piano on it, from Little Feet, who played on basically most of our albums. He was a keyboard player. And he came up with incredible parts, and he and Ted would work out stuff. So in the bridge of that song, this is before it had words, in other words, is what I'm implying. Right. I didn't have any lyrics for that song. And it went, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He did that, and I went, wow. So I went off and wrote all this stuff about the sheriffs with the samurai swords and all this crazy little town called China Grove. And I thought I was making it up. And at that time, I was making it up, as you would with anything else. But I got told by a cab driver in Houston a year later, he says, no, there really is a China Grove. I said, get out of here. He says, no, I'm serious. It's right down by San Antonio. So that's why I said it's got to be something that I saw on a road sign and didn't know.
Okay, the album cover, you're on the freeway that is not finished, I think out near Pasadena or something.
Yeah, a Selimar or something
like
that.
Right, right. So how did you decide to do that?
We didn't. That was Warner's idea. And they were, I have to say, at that point in time, the record company was your manager. They did everything. And did not only the artwork, but they also got, you know, a lot. They'd hook you up with the promoters and all that kind of stuff. Totally different scene from what's going on now. And so they came up with this idea to go out. This was from an earthquake in 1971. I think it was left over from that. And so they wanted to take pictures on top of that stretch of road that just fell off. And we did that. And they brought out from the movie studios, Warner Brothers movie studios, they brought out all the clothes we were wearing. They brought out the horse team and that stagecoach. And we did that shot down below the freeway, as it is on the front of the album cover. But we also did the shots on the centerfold, or whatever you want to call it, the inside of the album. That was up on top on this big old table with chalices and all this stuff and top hats.
So that album comes out. Are you aware it's going to be such a monster?
No. You know, people ask you that a lot. It's like somebody asking you, did you ever think when you wrote whatever that it would still be played almost 50 years? I said, hell no. How could you possibly know? It's unknowable. That's not something you could say, oh, 50 years from now, this song is, nobody knows those kind of things. It's impossible to know those kind of things. So it's always an interesting question when people ask you that stuff.
So suddenly you are literally everywhere. I remember in concert on TV, seemingly every mm-hmm. time you turn on the TV, you guys are on. So at that point, you must feel pretty good.
It was neat. It was a lot of fun. Plus, we had gone international by then, and we were playing, you know, over the pond. We played it at the Rainbow in London, which was really the in spot to play in that period in time. We also played in a lot of other towns in England. We also played in Germany, and we played in France. We played in Paris. All this stuff like was growing, and it happened really fast. You didn't have time to think about it. It's just all of a sudden you're there and you're doing it. And that crazy Warner Brothers tour in 74 with six bands was really a lot of fun.
Tell my audience if you remember what six bands those
were. It was called the Warner Brothers Music Tour.
Right.
And it was to promote everybody that was on it. And we were supposedly the lead band, but Little Feat was on it, and they were incredible. This is while they were really hot.
Right.
Tower of Power was on it. Montrose was on it. Larry Graham's, you know, Graham Central Station,
right.
And a band called Bonnaroo. And so what we would do is each night we would play, they would do not a lottery thing, but they would change up the guys that were going to be, the three bands were going to play. And so everybody played with everybody on one night or another. And I remember one night we played in Leeds and Elton John showed up. And he played with all three bands that were playing that night, which was us, I want to say, maybe Little Feat and Bonnaroo. Kind of unclear because it changed on regularly. But he got up on stage with each band. And then I ended up riding back to London in the back of his P5 Roller along with Jeff Baxter. And that was my first time around Elton John. And then, see ya. Stuff like that happened a lot. And that tour was insane. It was crazy. But at the same time, you learn stuff doing that, and songs got written on that tour, not for the Doobies, but I remember sitting down with Larry Graham and Butch, his B3 player, and he wrote This Ain't Nothing But a Warner Brothers Party, which came out to describe that tour. It was a great tune. It was a funky tune. And I was playing guitar, you know, helping with the rhythm end of it, and just a lot of camaraderie. Hanging out with guys that you really respected a lot as musicians and really liked their music. And it was a very cool thing. Really enjoyed it.
Okay, but now, is there any blowback from other musicians because you're so successful?
No, I don't recall that ever happening. You mean in other bands?
Yeah.
No, not at all. Uh-uh.
And now that you're so big, you know.
I don't know that we were as big as you're implying.
No. And listen, this is even when I write something good, I have a, you know, minimal amount of reach compared to you. But when you're the creator, you're at the eye of the hurricane. People are talking about you all the time, and there's things that you have no idea of.
I was just going to say, you're not aware of it.
No, you're completely unaware of what it is. You know, you're just with the same guys you know.
You're still playing a gig, and you're still going to the next town. It doesn't change any.
No, I mean, there was a moment. I very vividly remember when Captain Me came out. It was seemingly everywhere, and it was one track after another on the radio, on all formats. And the Doobie Brothers, you know, they'd had the hit before we listened to the music, but it was really the top. So then you have another album coming up to follow that up, which is What Were Once Vices Are Now Habits. The title there?
Pat Simmons came up with that title.
Okay.
It was an apt title.
Okay. Now, I love that album, but at first the album did not live up to its financial, what people thought it might be. The first track was Another Park, Another Sunday, which I love. I play it all the time to this day. But that didn't make it as far as the other tracks.
Well, and to the best of my understanding, because it was always a little unclear to me, but that got yanked off the radio by Warner's. It wasn't their idea to yank it off the radio. It's supposedly from being under pressure by radio stations saying, you can't have a song that says, and the radio just seems, or the radio just brings me down. You can't do that. That's what I was told. I don't know if that was jive or what, but that's what I got. That might have been the party. Yeah. So the flip side of it was Blackwater, which started in Roanoke getting spins by a local DJ, and it started gaining popularity and getting listens, and people liked it. And then it somehow morphed into Minnesota, I think it was, and started getting real heavy rotation. And the next thing you know, it's a nationwide hit. It was our first number one record.
Okay, I got to believe you never thought that was going to be a hit.
I didn't think about it one way or the other. I wasn't choosing singles. They were choosing singles. I just wrote songs that I wrote and passed.
Okay,
wrote the songs
but all of a sudden, you know, I remember being, that's when I first moved to LA. I remember, you know, the song would come on the radio and the people in the car would literally sing different parts.
Mm, yeah, you know, it was around. Yeah,
exactly. It was really big. And did you then perceive that the band was any bigger than it had been, or you already felt you were at a certain level?
Once again, when you get to a certain place where you're on the road all the time, everything is everything. You don't really pay attention to that.
And at what point did you move out of 12th Street?
73.
Okay. And you move where?
To Marin County.
Okay. So at this point, you have money?
I had some money. I wasn't wealthy, but I had some money. I bought a house. So I had enough money to do that.
Remember
but in
how
those
much-
days, it wasn't like buying a house would be in Fairfax, which is where I moved. Would be now.
Right. And you buy a good car?
I did buy a car, yes. I bought an Audi, early Audi. And so I had enough money to do those kinds of things.
Right.
And mostly I would spend a lot of money on guitars and amps. And
okay, at this late date, how many guitars do you have?
Then, this is before I really went nuts doing that. I probably had I had probably 10 guitars.
And how many do you have now?
I went through the phase where I had 40 guitars and left it behind and got rid of most of them. But at this point, I probably have 20 guitars now.
And when you go on the road, how many do you bring?
None. They're already out there. They stay in Nashville where our stuff is, all our stuff is, drums, keyboards, guitars, amps, everything. So it's all sitting in a locker, and when you go out, then the stuff gets on, you know, it's put on the truck, and it's driven to wherever you're going to practice before you start gigging, and then you do the rehearsals, and then you start playing.
So in your home now, which is where?
I live up in Marin County still.
Okay.
Different town, but...
Okay, but you have guitars in the house now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I have a studio upstairs, a writing studio. It's not a full-on studio, but it's where I do my writing now.
Okay, the next album is Stampede, okay? Jeff Baxter suddenly in the band.
He was already in the band. Jeff started hanging around with us. We had been playing with Steely Dan, and he would come over and hang out with us when he wasn't doing them. In fact, he would go on some of our tours when they went off the road, which I think was probably late 73, early 74. And he ended up on stage with us playing, and he was a phenomenal player. He played pedal steel, he played great leads, and he also played pull string, which is something I was unfamiliar with at that time, which was a Telecaster. I mean, the strap was hooked up to a strap lock, but if you pulled on it, it changed the tones on the guitar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it sounded like a pedal steel. It was really an interesting device, and I haven't seen it since. It was on a Telecaster.
Okay, how come he doesn't play anymore? Do you have any contact with him?
I played a benefit with him about, 4 months ago now. He still plays. He still plays great.
Okay.
He has done some things that have been pretty interesting with the Pentagon and all the
right.
rest of that. But he just finished moving back, I want to say, to Virginia to be with his daughter and his grandchild.
Okay. You cut Stampede. Are you as happy with Stampede as you are with the previous records?
I was.
You were.
I was enamored with it because... Got to do Take Me in Your Arms, number one.
Okay, so whose decision?
I take claim for that because I had tried for a couple of years to get the band to do that. And I wasn't getting any takers initially. And then eventually, I guess Ted came to bat for me, and they liked it. It's not they didn't like it. They just maybe didn't hear what I heard. I said, this would be killer. And then the arrangement, well, the arrangement took place in the studio with Ted overseeing the whole thing. And he brought in some chick singers who were fabulous. I think it was Bonetta Fields, Shirley Matthews, and one other gal. It wasn't Clydie King. And I can't remember what her name was, but boy, they were something else. For that album, we had that. I had an exploration song called Music Man where I got to play backward solos, more than one. So it was my Hendrix moment, if you will.
Right.
That was a big deal to me. But it was a cool song. And it also had Curtis Mayfield did the strings on it.
Really?
Which, unfortunately, I didn't get to go to that set. It was in Chicago. Teddy flew back to Chicago. They did the strings, and he had his Wawa Watson, whoever it was, guitar player that did the Wawa. It wasn't really strumming. It was more of a sound effect. It was really cool. It sounded like all of a sudden we were doing a Curtis Mayfield song, but rock and roll. And I was very enamored with that tune, and it was never a single or anything. It was just fun to do. And then there was another song on there that we cut just extemporaneously. It was cut in a garage in Nashville. We were there a year and a half, 2 years before. The guy's name was Buzz Kayson, and it was out on Murfreesboro Road. And I was with the former drummer of Mother Earth, Carl Himmel. And he was just hanging out. We were just hanging out. It was nobody's idea to do anything. We ended up at Buzz Kayson's studio. We had a 16-track out there. Tyron was with us. And so the three of us put this track down that we just made up on the spot. I made up the words on the spot, which never really got written, so they stayed those words. And then we added those chick singers. This happened in 73, by the way. And that, 2 years later, ended up on Stampede. And it was called Working On You. And it was just a fun song to do. And it ended like an old Manassas ending or something. Everything just kind of falls apart at the end.
Oh, that's funny you mentioned that. The first double album, the Manassas album. I know exactly what you're talking about. Great record.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it all falls apart, right?
My ulcer bloomed, yeah. I had an ulcer in high school. And due to the frantic living pace of, you know, being on the road all the time and all the crazy stuff that went along with that, it got worse, and it got pretty bad. And so I had, right when the tour for Stampede was taken off, I had to leave, and that was a drag. But that's what happened. So that's when they just started doing it on their own, and then they Jeff Baxter suggested bringing in Michael McDonald just to play keyboards and sing backgrounds. And that's how it was for that tour.
Who sang your parts?
Pat did a lot of it.
Okay.
Pat Simmons did a lot of the singing. And I wasn't there to watch any of this, but
right.
That's my understanding. And then they started working on Take It to the Streets, which is when Michael contributed as a songwriter. And which, that song being one of them, Take It to the Streets. I had one song on that album, and that's all I contributed, and by the time they go out for a spring tour, I went out with them.
Oh, you did?
I did, and we did
this before the album came out.
No, the album was out.
Okay, I remember the spring of '76. I remember buying
exactly.
it,
yeah.
And it sounded so different from what came before.
It was very different from what came before.
Did you go on the road with them?
I did. I did that tour with them, and then I stayed with the band. And had I think 4 or 5 songs for the next album, which was Living on the Fault Line. Which I don't think did that well, all things considered, especially after Taken to the Streets was pretty successful and all the previous albums had been pretty successful. And I just decided I'm going to withdraw for right now. I'm not sure I feel a part of this musically. I don't feel like I'm in the right spot. And I just wanted a break. So I left. And I spent a year playing baseball, lifting weights, getting healthy again, if you will. And then I started writing again. And the next thing you know, I'm doing a solo album in 79 with Ted.
Right.
So it all, you know, I didn't stay away very long.
We'll stop here for a brief moment and get right back to my conversation with Tom Johnston. For those who are unaware, I'm primarily a writer and have a newsletter called The Left Sets Letter. You can sign up and read the history of my work at leftsets.com. In addition to experiencing my commentary on music, business, technology, and my life, you'll be the first to find out when we've published a new episode of the podcast. Go to leftsets.com and sign up for the newsletter. I know you'll enjoy it. Now, more with Tom Johnston of the Doobie Brothers, recorded live at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. Okay, so once again, now you're a solo act. What are your expectations and what's it like?
It's pretty different. First of all, you're in the driver's seat, and it was an exploration album as well. I look back at it now, they weren't the greatest songs ever. And I hadn't been planning on doing it, and then I ended up getting to do it. So I kind of wrote the songs hastily, if you will. But it had one song on it that did fairly well, which was Savannah Nights. And it was all kind of an R&B-ish album, but I got to do a lot of stuff that I always wanted to do but never could.
Right.
The Doobies. I got to use Tower's horn section, and I got David Garibaldi on drums and Cheese Chudikoff from a band called Crack and played bass, and it sounded sort of like rock. So I wanted to be like a Tower Power kind of unit. The song started off sounding like a Temptations song. It ended up sounding like a James Brown song.
Back to your roots.
Yeah, it was wild how that happened. But none of these are singles. They were just fun to do. And we used so many different players. That's another thing I wasn't. Yeah, I mean, we'd had other guys come in on the albums through the period of three or four albums in there who were studio guys. We had Ry Cooder play on an album. We had Arlo Guthrie play on an album. We had Malcolm Cecil and, is it Bob Margulis, I think?
Yeah, exactly.
They came in and set
Tonto's
up
Tonto's expanding headband.
Yeah, they did a lot of stuff with Stevie Wonder and
right,
everything.
Exactly.
They set up the synthesizer, and I played the keyboard horn parts on Captain and Me for Natural Thing and Ukiah.
I love Natural Thing. Opening yeah. song on...
it was fun to do.
Right, you know.
I had no idea what these guys were all about. They just showed up and set up this big monster thing. I went, okay, I'll play it on keyboards.
Well, when you're in the heat of the moment, you say, but now suddenly you're out of the Doobie Brothers, and the Doobie Brothers have a renaissance, and they're as successful as you were at your heyday.
They were very successful.
Not the same sound, but it's called the Doobie Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
It was pretty different, and it's like an adjustment that you have to make. But I didn't want to change what I was about and what I was musically, where I came from. And the interesting part about all that is both Michael and I are R&B guys. I have a lot of R&B influences. His was a little different than mine. Mine was like I started with Little Richard and worked my way up through Joe Tex and Wilson Pickett and all those kind of guys. He was more into the Ray Charles and the more gospel kind of things. So you could have that much variation and go and completely different directions. And he was a keyboard player, I was a guitar player. So that was probably the difference. And stylistically, song-wise, it was very different. Because I still had a rock and roll edge to a lot of the stuff I did. And so when it came time to do solo albums, as I said, the first one was an experiment. A lot of fun. I had a ball doing that album. That was so much fun. Got to play with guys, some of which I didn't even know it. David Page played on it.
From Toto.
Yeah. A plethora of drummers. Keith played on it. Michael played on that album at some point. Pat played on that album. Rick Schlosser played on a lot of the tracks. I'm not sure what happened to Rick. Mark Jordan was a keyboard player. He was really good, and he played on a lot of stuff. Towers horns. I used Memphis horns on a couple of the songs. So you've got this plethora of really top-notch players. And that, to me, is what that experience was all about. It was a growth period. And then I went out and toured on it. And did a lot of gigs with various bands. Kenny Loggins was one of them I toured with for a while. And it was a pretty wild and woolly tour. You got the band, such as it was, which was me, three Memphis horns, John Hartman, and something Anderson on the other set. We had two drummers again. Mike White on bass. Probably nobody's not going to be familiar with these names. They weren't household names. But So we went out and toured. So the crew and the band are all on the same bus every night. And it was lunacy.
Right, right, exactly.
That lasted for a month and a half, and then that was the end of the touring for that album. And then I did another solo album with a different producer. So that's another big step. And those were actually, in a sense, more commercial songs, but the album didn't do very well. And I was told that it sounded too much like the Doobie Brothers. I said,
wasn't that a good thing? I am the Doobie
I don't
Brothers.
Know if that is good or bad or indifferent. I said, I'm not trying to do anything in particular. I'm just writing songs, and here's what they sound like. And that one was produced by Michael Omardian, who did Christopher Cross right. and some other people like that. And then after that, I just kind of played around Marin and hung out with a band called Border Patrol, and we did gigs and stuff. And that lasted until 87. And then in 87, Keith had this idea. The band, by the way, the Doobie
well,
Brothers
before you
by
get
then.
There, okay, you make two solo records, then Warner Brothers says they don't want to make any more, right?
Correct.
Okay, now you don't have. You're not at the level you were before without a recording deal. Do you try to get a recording deal with somebody else?
No.
Okay. Do you have enough money to get you through?
I did.
Okay.
I wasn't, like, large and in charge, but right. I was getting by.
Okay. And, okay, so then get to 87.
Okay, well, the band, the Doobie Brothers.
Right, they ended.
They split up in 92. They did a farewell tour.
82.
Yeah, excuse me, 82. Right. Yeah. And they did a farewell tour, which I went and played on one of the last gigs with them over in Berkeley, and which was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed
it.
So
you remain friendly with these guys?
Pretty much, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, I sat in with them in Seattle one night when they were playing with John Kay, and he was doing his solo album thing. And you know, I didn't sit in with them a lot, but once in a while I would show up. And when the night they got their first Grammys and stuff, I was on that first solo tour. And I ended up in Bakersfield, drove down to L.A., and went to the after party and hung out with all the guys in the band and Mo Austin and everybody else right. who was there. So, yeah, we stayed on good terms.
And then in 87, there's this idea.
There was an idea by Keith Knudsen, who had read a book, which I don't remember the title of, about guys who had fought in Vietnam and what they were going through and the problems they were having. Health-wise, housing-wise, you name it. They were having all kinds of problems. And he called each one of us in the band and said, would you be interested in getting together and doing a gig to raise money for these guys? And everybody said, sure, why not? And that included four drummers, four guitar players, one bass player who was Tyrant, because Willie Weeks had been playing bass for the band at the end. And Michael, of course, on one side, and Cornelius Bumpus on the other side playing keyboards, and then Cornelius played sax. So we had this huge conglomerate on stage, which was insane. So we had to rehearse that, get the songs together, which is everything from Nobody to Minute by Minute, all of it in one night. And the first gig was a trial gig before we did the Hollywood Bowl,
right?
Which was the prize. That was the one we wanted to get the money for the Vietnam vets from. So we played in San Diego at a place we used to play all the time. I think it was called the Sportatorium, if I'm not mistaken. And so we get there and we walk on stage expecting absolutely nothing because we hadn't done anything in all the formats at once for sure. And we had never done anything with that many guys on stage. And the band had been apart for a while, so nobody's really expecting a heck of a lot of anything. And we get this standing ovation.
Wow.
They would not let us start playing. It was ridiculous. And everybody's looking at each other going, what the fuck is going on, man? This is crazy. Nobody had an inkling that anything like that was going to happen. So apparently the band had been missed in its absence, but we didn't know it. And so we ended up playing the show. The crowd was ecstatic. So we left that thinking, wow, that's amazing. I wasn't expecting that. And I mean, everybody's saying that. Wow, that was something.
Right. Wrong.
And so the next show is probably the next night, actually, at the Hollywood Bowl, and it was the second fastest-selling show they'd had behind the Beatles. That was the fastest one. And it was packed. And we played the show, made a ton of money for the Vietnam vets, and we played one more for the Stanford Children's Hospital, which was one of our pet charities, after that. And then we played 10 shows to pay for all this. because it cost a fortune to do all the rehearsing and everything.
And everybody, the whole routine, the multiple drummers, guitarists, they went on all those 10 gigs?
Yep. And we played them like you would a small tour. You know, we played in
that Denver. Was always the plan.
No, but that's just the way we ended up. And because we had this huge debt we'd incurred putting this together. But while we were doing the rehearsal, putting this together and doing the songs from the early Doobie period, Ted was there for all the rehearsals. And he came up to all the guys from the original band. He said, what would you think about reforming the band in its original form and doing an album? And at that point, none of us were doing anything that really mattered. And we all said, sure, why not? So we did. And that was supposed to happen in 88. It didn't happen until 89. And Ted wasn't the producer, and we weren't on Warner Brothers. Right, a lot of stuff changed from the idea till it actually happened. By then, we were on Capitol.
And do you think it would have been different if Ted had been the producer?
I do. I do. Because we started off with a couple of producers at one time, Eddie Schwartz and Charlie Midnight. And then that morphed into Rodney Mills. And then he did the second album that was on Capitol. And we, the first album was Cycles, and it did pretty well. And it had The Doctor on it, which I wrote with those two guys. If I hadn't written it with those two guys, because I already had written this song for a band I was playing in Marin, but it didn't have that chorus.
Right.
And it didn't have some of those lyrics. If those had not been added, that song wouldn't have been a hit. That was the catchy part of it for them. I mean, if they hadn't added that those chord structures and stuff, which I thought, yeah, that's really poppy. It's like almost bubblegum. But it did well, and it served its purpose. And the band was back, if you will. Then we did the second album, which was Brotherhood. It didn't do so well. And then we just have been on the road since.
Okay, so a couple of questions now. Let's stay with the recordings. You make a recording, Sibling Rivalry, I believe, in 2000. And there are, I believe that record's very good, but there are multiple writers. So when you have...
There was no producer. And I was against that. I didn't think that was a good idea. But this is what they wanted to do. They wanted to try doing it with no producer. I said, okay. So you do get multiple writers. You also get multiple sounds.
Exactly.
Because you got four guys singing lead. And I didn't think that was a great idea, but I didn't raise a ruckus about it too much. So the album really didn't do anything, and we weren't really on a label. It got put out by Rhino, but we were doing it with a guy from Florida, which is just a money guy, much like what we did 10 years later.
Okay, you make a record 10 years later, but at this time it is with Ted Templeman.
It was with Ted Templeman. It was not on Warner Brothers. It wasn't on any label.
Right.
It was, once again, a money guy who was from Texas, and... We were with what they call themselves a record company, but they really weren't. And it's too bad because that really was a good record. It had good songs on it. They were well thought on. Billy Payne came out and played on it. I had written four songs on keyboards. And so I just said, here,
right,
you're the
play.
Guy. You play these. But I had I'd written them on keyboards. And by then I'm working with... digital performer, and I could play all this stuff because of MIDI. It allows you to play bass, allows you to play drums, you could play keyboard parts, and you could fudge it. So if you can't really play the part, you're not fluid enough, you slow it down, and you play the part, and then you speed it back up again.
So you're down here in L.A. now for writing sessions. What would these songs be for?
We'd like very much to put out, at this point, probably an EP. Because people don't buy albums anymore.
Right.
They don't care about that. And to me, it's important to stay valid. To me, if you're a musician, if you just sit around and rest on your laurels, you're not growing and you're not getting the job done. We play plenty of gigs every year, and we love playing for people. That's what's kept the band thriving and alive. But I think there's something as a musician, and it's not just me that feels this way. We all feel this way. That in order to be valid, you need to put out new stuff. It's, you know, in this day and age, it's probably not going to do anything per se. It's not going to be some humongous hit. But people know you're still making an attempt to be honest about your music. And that to me is important.
And On one hand, you say nothing's going to happen, but on another hand...
Oh, I don't know what's going to happen.
But on the other hand, if you're actually doing it, you must have an inner flame saying, well, I would like
there's
it to
There's always
happen.
That. Yeah, at this right. point in the game, yes, there's always that hope. And right. I had that for World Gone Crazy. I thought that album was going to do something. I was right. really disappointed when it did.
So in this particular case, since you would be doing an EP somewhere between 4 and 6 songs, is there a desire to hit a certain level of quality to give your... project a better shot in the marketplace?
In some ways, I don't think that's ever changed. You always want to do the best you can do where you're at that time. With the knowledge you have, with the songs that you're writing. And that's what, you know, I'm co-writing at this point, which is something I never used to do. And I really enjoyed the two songs that I've written down here in L.A. with John. And it's been...
John Shanks.
Yes,
John Shanks. Okay, just for those people who are not up to speed.
And... Guy's got a lot of vision. It reminds me of Ted. He doesn't have personality. It's like night and day from Ted.
Right.
Not at all like. But he has vision and he hears things and it's mind-blowing because you're doing it in his studio and he's got an engineer. And as you're tracking, I mean, as you're writing the song, it's kind of what reminds me of my writings sessions in Nashville in that you've got 2 or 3 guys in the room all at the same time writing stuff. So as you're writing the chords... You're writing the verses. That's something I never did before in life. It was, I would write the song generally first.
Right.
The whole damn thing. And say, okay, what's going to work on this? With that type of writing where you've got more than yourself, you've got anywhere from 2 to 3 people in a room. It's like you get this first stretch of the song. Okay, let's write the verse. I said, well, we don't have a song done yet. They said, yeah, this is how we do it back here, whatever. And so it's a learning curve for me, and it was really interesting. And that was with Jeffrey Steele, and who has had a lot of success back there. He's an L.A. boy originally, and wrote with Chuck Cannon, wrote with Bob DiPiero. These guys are all successful back there in Nashville, most of his country.
And this is all for the same theoretical EP?
No, this was just for me to go back and write with people just to do it.
And what's happened to those songs?
So far, nothing. They are saying one of them might get used. I don't know yet. I there's one of them I think is a possibility for what we're doing.
Okay. And also, you switched managers relatively recently. What was that about?
We had reached a place with our former manager where we just thought it was time to cut ties. And actually, I'd been thinking that for a while. And without getting into depth about this, some things occurred that convinced other people in the band that it was time to do that. And we did. And so I took it upon myself to make some phone calls. And
so the decision to cut ties was before you had a new person?
Yep.
Okay.
And both the people that I called were receptive and positive about it. And the last person that we spoke with and the last person I called and that we went and sat down and had a meeting with was Irving Azoff. And he was great. He knew all about the band. He says, I know what you've been doing. I'd like you to meet our staff, and which is the same thing I did with another manager in Nashville. And he came out to us in St. Louis, and we had a big meeting. They were great. They really were. I mean, they were first class about the whole thing, both guys. It just seemed to me that it was a better fit. And after I got the guys down to L.A. and they saw what Irving was all about and how things were done and his people that did online presence and his people that did this and did that, they kind of agreed. And so we chose Irving.
And so since you've been with Irving... How is it different from your previous life?
Touring is still touring. That doesn't ever change.
Right.
But as far as the quality of how things are done, it's night and day. From the business standpoint, it's on another planet. So, and we also changed booking agencies. We went from Paradigm to CAA, which has also been a really neat thing for us to do and a very positive jump. And so it's all changed.
Right. And then, so the band has been back together in its original format or close there too for a better part of 30 years. How many days a year do you do gigs?
We do about 80 shows a year.
And how do you come up with that number?
I don't know. It's not really, we haven't got to a point where we sit down, I won't do more than this. It's just, that's what we've been doing for a while, anywhere between 80 to 100 shows up till about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And then we were kind of trying to keep it down to 80. At one point, we talked about 70. And in fact, since we've been with Irving, we were talking about, 70, but it hasn't happened yet. We're still doing 80. Because shows come up you don't want to say no to. That's pretty much one of the reasons.
They don't want to say no because?
Well, they're you want to go play with these people, perhaps. Shows come up out of the blue that you don't know are going to happen, like some of the stuff we did, like those classic gigs, for instance. They got interjected into a tour we were doing with Chicago at the time. Where you're going to go play with Steely Dan and the Eagles the day that you play, get on a plane and fly back to Detroit to play the next gig that night after you're done. And other things like going to Europe, and we played with Steely Dan, and then we did a European tour by ourselves in places, some of the places I'd actually never played before. It was kind of hip. Really enjoyed that.
Now when you're singing Listen to the Music, or you're singing one of your big hits, which you have to sing, or otherwise the audience is going to revolt.
They're not happy.
Are you thinking about doing your laundry? Or are you thinking about other stuff? Or are you still into
it? No, it's still a thrill to do those songs. And I'll tell you why. Because it could be exactly like you just described. I could see where that would happen. It's because of the response the crowd gives you when you play those songs. So in essence, every night, that song takes on a life of its own because of the people in front of you. Not because you're playing it. God, you know the thing in your sleep. But when the crowd is singing along with you, and in particular, there's a couple of songs that are anthemic in nature for that very reason. How can you not be happy with that, man? It's pretty hard.
Okay, so generally speaking, let's talk about when you're playing with another band. How far can you stretch it before the audience, I don't want to say tunes out, but we all go to shows these days, and you're on stage, whatever. There's the casual fan who knows the hits, and then there's the diehard fan. So when you don't play...
And a few people that don't really know any of the hits.
Right. So, A, to what degree do you feel you want to convince the fans, bring them along? Or to what's it like being on stage when you're not playing the big hits?
It might be songs that you really dug as album cuts in the first place. In particular, things like... For me, Dark Eyed Cajun Woman or something
meant
a lot to me alone as a person because it was the blues. And it was a tip of the hat to B.B. King. And it's the only time I ever got to write a blues song that really was a blues song.
And is there a Dark Eyed Cajun Woman?
There is a Dark Eyed Cajun Woman that really exists. It came off of Captain and Me. We'll be doing that. I have been doing it a lot.
No, but I mean, is there a woman who's...
Oh, no. It was all fictitious.
Right.
But... that was a big seminal moment for me in the studio. Not for anybody else, probably, but for me it was.
So you'll enjoy playing that live?
I do. I mean, there's a lot of songs I enjoy playing live. It's just how you build a set in order to take the crowd on this little journey with you, so to speak.
And do you find if you headline that the fans are a little more diehard as opposed to playing with somebody else?
If you're opening, let's say, for... the first tour we did when we got with Irving was with Journey.
Right.
And it was us and Dave Mason played before we did, and then we played, and then Journey played. So every night the places, which as they always are in any of these kind of shed gigs, they're always packed pretty much. We were getting really great response. So this is an extension of what we'd already been doing anyway. So it's more the same, but different bands than we had played with before. We'd played with Dave before, but we'd never played with Journey since way back when. And then this last year we've been with Steely Dan. We just finished that tour a month ago. We were out for over 2.5 months straight. And wide swath musically. I mean, you've got jazz rock and all these phenomenal players on stage. And Donald still sounds as great as ever. And really a killer band, but it's completely musically different from what we do. And the crowd loved it, which was very cool.
So it all works. Well, you've had a lot of hits. So at this, okay, a couple other questions. How many times have you been married?
Once, really. And I'm still married to her now. We've been married for over 30 years.
Okay, so because most bands seem the band goes on the road. I remember Metallica; they went on the road for an extended period of time. They came home, everybody got divorced. How did you maintain that relationship in the face of this crazy lifestyle?
Well, it's not that crazy nowadays. It's work, you know. I mean, you're out making a living. It's not the days of the 70s and the heyday of, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll are gone. It's a job, but I enjoy the job. I love playing music. And I love, as does everybody else in this band, interacting with the crowd. And to me, as a musician, when I'm on stage, the penultimate job that you have is to get that crowd up every single night. And barring security guys and a place that won't allow them to get up, and even then, I still try. But the idea is to get them up, dancing, sing along with you if they know the songs, which in a lot of cases they do. That's an every night thing.
And on that note, what a better time to end with the pinnacle moment of what's still going on the road. You can certainly see the Doobie Brothers on the road, as we said, 80 times a year. They come to your marketplace eventually. But even so, the records, I really would say, go back to listen to those early records, Vices and Toulouse Street and The Captain Me. They don't really sound like anything else in the marketplace. There's a unique sound. And as a result, they're also not dated. It also has something to do with the high level they're recorded on, but really satisfying music. I mean, I literally play them all the time, so it's a thrill to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Appreciate it. My pleasure.
Till next time, it's Bob Lefsetz. You're listening to me on my own podcast, recorded live here at TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. How great was that? Listen, I'm a huge Doobie Brothers fan. To sit here and get answers to some questions I've had for decades and listen to Tom talk about what it's like being in the band and being on the road was very special and stimulating. I know you loved it too. Till next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.